Today's program is brought to you by Thurman Maple Days. Celebrate flowing of sap in the Adirondacks, self-guiding to 7 sites for talks, tours, tastes, and old-fashioned friendliness. For more information, visit ThurmanMapleDays.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live at noon, actually, Stas. What do you think about that?
Crazy.
The Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting from Roberta's Pizzeria. Where, Jack?
Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah. Joined, as usual, in the studio with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
And Jackie Molecules, what's up?
I'm doing well.
Good, good. We are going to be joined shortly by the late arriver, I guess is like, you know, planning on my usual arrival time. Peter Kim, you know.
He got a different name for him before the show started.
What was it?
Oh, yeah. Family show, Jack. Family show. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So, Stas, on the magnificent L train on the way over here today.
I was on that.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Just the one
I'm
that
always
just got
on
in?
It. No. No.
The one before me?
Maybe.
Anyways, I'm never on the L train to get here. Anyways, dude had so much ketchup on his face, like just ketchup all over his face. And I'm like, dude, like a little bit of ketchup, like on your cheek. Like, all right, fine, whatever.
What was
like
he eating?
Well, no, that's the thing. He had done eating. He wasn't one of these freaks in the subway, like jamming his face full of like pot pie or something. But he had like, it was like he had taken a fistful of French fries, gone in the ketchup and then like shoved it into his face and got it all over his face.
Gross.
But here's the thing. If you have that much ketchup on your face, you can smell it. You can smell it. You're like, why do I still smell ketchup? You know what I mean? Like,
what a horrible thing to have on your face, too.
Yeah, just like a boat ton of ketchup. Oof. Crazy. Not right.
I have a caller on if you want to get right to it.
No, let's get right to it. Let's get right into business. Caller, you are on the air.
Hey, Dave. It's Judo from Silver Spring, Maryland. How are you?
Doing all right.
So, question for you. You know how in Liquid Intelligence you have kind of that shopping list? Excuse me, that shopping list, and it's like grouped together by.
Oh, did we lose you? Oh my God, we lost. I do know the shopping list. I'm familiar with the shopping list. I was thinking about this also.
You still there?
Maybe.
Hello.
Oh yeah, you're back. Yeah. The shopping list. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. So. You know, that list that you have where it's kind of grouped into like, these are your necessities, this is if you have a little bit more money, and this is if you want to go crazy.
Right.
So, say you were doing the same thing for a commercial kitchen, think for like a deli.
Mm.
You know, how might you group that?
Okay, well, what kind of deli? What are you serving?
So, we're going to be doing everything in-house except for baking bread, but, you know, cooking roasts from scratch. You know, making some prepared meals like soups and stews, some basic catering also, but, you know, nothing too fancy, at least at the outset. I'm trying to look to how I can bootstrap it as much as possible. Thinking if I switch to induction, does it require the use of a hood? You know, that sort of thing. So really trying to be creative with our expenses there.
Right. Well, you could definitely, I mean, I don't know what your venting requirements are, but, you know, the situation rather, but you can definitely reduce the CFMs or the venting you need by going induction. I know a lot of people also who just basically cheat and they do their hot side on induction and then take it away when they're not using it. And that's totally viable. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It all depends on what you can get away with in your locale. But you know, if you're going to do any traditional deli stuff, I would invest in the sweetest slicers that you could possibly get. Right, and so like, I'm. What kind of slicer are you getting?
I'm buying a company that's already existing, but I'm trying to think of it like, this place is so mismanaged. I have to think how I would start from scratch. So the guy told me they have like a 70-year-old Hobart slicer, which is, you know, just on an angle.
Okay. Now look, let's just take the slicer, because to me, like, the heart And this is kind of pathetic the way I think, but the heart of like a deli operation is like your slicer, right? So slicers, obviously, you know, I don't know how long you have to deal with the one that you currently have, but the issue with the angle gravity feed slicer, which is, you know, the American standard for slicers, is that regardless of, you know, how sharp you keep the blade, you're going to get some toe out on the, you know, some healing out on the bottom of the meat as you cut. And you know what I'm talking
right.
about that.
Yeah.
And that's just the nature of the beast when you're using a gravity fed slicer. Now, you know, what does that really mean? It means that you have to like take it off or rotate it as you slice or take it off and take that little heel piece off and it's unpleasant. Is that like a life ender? No. But if you were curing your own meats and like, you know, you really cared about it and you're dealing with high value stuff, you don't want that to happen. Now, the modern gravity slicers are a lot better in that respect because they require a lot more down pressure than some of the older ones do. And you know my favorite, the Model 3000, the Hobart Model 3000, which is like was like such a pimped out machine, like that did a very good job on thin slices. The Bezerba, you know, which was before that other one, the one that, and by the way, I'm a couple of years behind, like 3-4 years it's been since I really worried about slicers. Was the best. But you know, if you're going to do a high end presentation deli kind of a situation, eventually you might want to get a vertical, like to because a vertical slicer A looks freaking awesome and B like doesn't have any of that distortion on the slices it goes through. That said, the only people I know who use them are like, you know, the people trying to do like the high end Italian style kind of service, you know, who don't want to do hand slicing. I don't have a lot of personal experience with them, but the good thing about like the newer slicers is the reason I like the 3000 is just the ease of cleaning on it too. Like it's got that like hydraulic lift that you can lift up the slicer and clean underneath it. You could pop the blade off and throw it in the dishwasher, which is sweet. I hate cleaning slicers. I got to tell you, I do not like cleaning them.
Yeah, I got a really nasty cut 1 year doing that.
Ooh, yeah. Now, obviously, I'm not even going to get it because I don't know the layout, but, like, refrigeration is going to be huge on you, like, getting, like, good cases because you're going to throw a lot of money into electricity on those cases over time. And so even though, like, an old set of refrigerator cases might seem like a good bargain right now, A, like, they might break on you more of. I've said this before. I hate commercial refrigeration. I really do. But like, you know, good refrigeration setup, you know, that's not going to go down. And I don't know who's got the best one right now. But you know, those are like the heart, right? So you got your refrigeration setup, you got your slicer. Then on your cooking side stuff, I would definitely invest in a couple, especially if you're not going to do, you said you're not going to do a lot of hot side right away, right?
Right.
Yeah, just get some decent induction ones. Like, you know, there's actually, you know, it's interesting. They Breville, is that semi-commercial, semi-pro? Like, Philip Preston from Polyscience did some work with a new temperature-controlled induction unit that's supposed to be pretty good, at least he tells me so, that I think is – I'm going to say it's right in between the consumer and the pro range. But it could be good for swapping in and out. Otherwise, most people I know use, you know, the big old Cooktex. You know what I mean? But they're pretty expensive. Whereas most of the other, you know, the smaller induction ones, the cheap ones, you can get away with them fine for a while, but they're not necessarily the best long term because they have a fairly small heat ring, so you can get some scorching if you're doing work that requires like saute or anything like that. They can fuzz out on you over time if you're using them hard and intensively, but. Well, on the other hand, they're cheap like potato chips. You know what I mean? They're like
sure.
a couple hundred bucks, so you can like rip through them, you know, as you need to. What else am I? If you're gonna do catering, I would get a vacuum bag. I would get a vacuum machine. And if you're gonna get a vacuum machine, in your setup, I would not go for the smallest one. I don't think you need to get a really big one unless you're gonna be vacuuming down Maybe you are. Maybe you're going to be vacuuming down like whole roasts, doing a pre-circ on them, and then a roast out later in an oven. I don't know. You know, that's something you should kind of look forward to, because that's another large investment, a vacuum machine. You're going to probably need a Hassaplant as well for it. But that's definitely going to be useful both in a catering application for takeaway later, and also if you ever – and go to the Underground Meat Collective section on their Hassap, because they do vacuum for takeaway. So then if you're going to make your own products, do a slice down and a vac pack out so that you can push. You don't want to have to do all of your heavy slicing necessarily to order on something when you want to grab and go, and you might want to be able to prepackage something, in which case you're going to need a decent vacuum machine.
Right, right. So I was just looking at the mini pack lines and the I think it was the XP45 or the MVS 45, you know, I was trying to figure out like if that would be too big or if I could get away with something smaller. But you're saying
no,
don't go for the smallest thing.
No. Yeah, no. Yeah. The 45 is the smallest one for your application that I think I would go. That's the same size as the as on the multivac. That's the same size, I think, as what, the 200. It's been a long time since I've shot, but yeah, that's the smallest one that I would go for, because you know what. Like, do you really want to be in a situation where, you know, you saved – because the price difference is not that big, right? And the size is not
right.
That much different. And do you really want in 6 months' time to say, I wish I could pack that down? No, you don't.
Right.
You know, what I used to recommend – also, look, a lot depends on what you're going to do. So, you know, I had the pleasure of having a dual bar set up in both machines that I was using, right? And the advantage of the dual bar, having two bars in it, is that you can seal two packages at once. And that becomes a really big deal if you are going to do packaging down of stuff for sale, not just for like storage at the end of the night, but because like let's say your vacuum cycle time is like 40 seconds, 35, 30, somewhere between 30 and 40 seconds, you know, in between each cycle, right? Which it could easily be. It could be longer even, depending on what you're doing. So by having two bars where you can seal two packages at once, you know, across from each other, you're cutting your packaging time in half. And if you've ever gone on a big packaging marathon where you're packaging package after package after package, then you know, it can be significant. The savings can be significant for not a huge initial extra investment.
Got it.
And
yeah, that makes sense.
Here's the thing. People are like, the bar. It takes up – the extra bar takes up so much space. And in fact, that's crap, because you can just rip the bar out when you're not using it. I've done it a billion times. You just rip the bar out when you're not using it, and then you have the full space where the other bar used to be. You know what I mean?
Right.
For someone like you, I don't know that gas flush is going to be so important. You know, I don't know. Like, I don't know that many people who use it all the time, but anyway, there you have it.
All right, we had okay. Another caller who's been waiting.
Oh, all right, wait.
Thank you very much.
If you have any more questions, give us a call back. All right, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dick. This is Anderson Pittsburgh.
How you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you today?
Doing well.
So I have a question for you. I committed the cardinal sin when doing things at home where I didn't write down exactly what I had done to get a result.
Right.
But I think I have this one pretty much nailed on. So I'm a bartender, and I used a recipe from Keller's French Laundry for one of the syrups that we use at the bar. I used a Tella Cherry pepper syrup, which is Tella Cherry, black peppercorns, raspberries, strawberries, sugar, water. And then he just kind of poaches it for 45 minutes to keep it from getting cloudy.
Right.
The ratio that he uses are going to be – he uses – a pint of raspberries, a pint of strawberries, a cup of water, 3/4 cup of sugar, which isn't going to be nearly enough sugar to get to a 50 bricks symbol. So, I mean, I've got a refractometer. The first time I made it, I just kind of was like, throw some water and sugar in there. I'll just correct it whenever I'm done. And whenever it came out, I had developed a whole bunch of pectin in the syrup. So when I was blending it to get more sugar into it to correct the bricks, it created this really amazing stable foam on top.
Huh.
That's super, super delicious. And then the second time I did it, the foam wasn't stable. So what I'm thinking is that I think what happened is I just developed more pectin the first time I did it. And I want to call you and ask you, what kind of are the ideal conditions for developing pectin in fruits whenever you're making a syrup like that.
Right.
Oh, and yeah. I'm sorry, real quick. The way that I do it is like a double boiler method. So I put all my ingredients in the mixing bowl over boiling hot water and just keep that hot so it pushes and has no chance of boiling.
Right. So what you want is like basically not a fully gelled, obviously, but like semi, right? So like the problem with that and pectin is like, you know, getting the ratios exactly right each time to make it right. Now, in general, right, pectin will form gels in situations where there is a high soluble solids, right? So lower water and usually typically a lot of sugar. That's why a lot of times when people try to make jellies and they're like, oh, my jelly didn't set, it's because they don't have enough sugar in it, right? And the other thing is acid, right? So like maybe the batch that had the good pectin development was a little more acidic than normal, right? And then you doped it with extra sugar. So then you have a high sugar, high acid situation. Pectin loves that. You know what I mean? And so typically, you know, there, you can have like ionic reactions as well, but I think typically you're going to just look for high soluble solids high soluble solids and acid conditions, and that's going to increase the set characteristics of your pectin. But that said, like wacky things happen with fresh fruit, and you never know. Like if you got like a really good result, it's like super hard to duplicate it.
Right. I was using frozen raspberries and fresh strawberries whenever I did it.
Yeah, I don't think that should affect it much. Like freezing. Could be wrong, though. I often am.
Yeah. So what you're saying is just add a little bit of acid, like either lemon juice or just citric acid or something, and that should help correct it?
Well, like, I think once it's done, once it's cooked out, it's like, you know, it's probably cooked out. But you didn't write down the exact ratios you did that time?
No, that's what I was talking about, just cardinal sin.
I mean, look, I told you, I've said it on the air, like, you know, there's recipes that I've never been able to achieve again, ever. But a lot of these recipes with, especially recipes that rely on hydrocolloids, like, a lot of them are on a razor-thin edge. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's like, and the problem with those is you could be chasing unicorns, right? So, you know, let's say the syrup that you did, even if you measured it exactly, let's say you're talking about a 1 in 100 shot. Well, you can't do a recipe based on a 1 in 100 shot. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, so you might want to think about doping it with some foaming agent. I mean, strawberry is pretty foamy anyway.
Yeah.
Like even regular clarified strawberry is pretty foamy. So, strawberry soda foams like a mother. So does raspberry soda, really. You know, even when I hit it with Pectinex. So it's, but getting it exactly the way you want it, I would consider just doping it with some whipping agent and some, I've been looking into it. In fact, someone else asked last week about vegan egg replacers, and then I had a comment back in on the HMC additives. There's got to be a good thing just to add to make it happen, because you don't want to rely on having to get something exactly right every time that is like on such a fine teeter totter. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't realize that getting patch development would be that fine of a razor edge.
Well, because you don't want it fully gelled. You want something in between. In between things are always the hardest. By the way, the recipe that Keller has you cooking the peppercorns for 40 minutes? Or do you throw – see, here's the thing. So like Jeffrey Steingarten, you know, friend of the show, friend of mine, he once lambasted me for putting pepper into things early, because he's like – when you cook pepper that – he doesn't talk to this. When you cook pepper that long, it's like all that's left is the bitterness, none of the aroma of the pepper. I'm like, you know, so what? Like, I still like to add pepper early because I kind of like that like harsh bitterness from the pepper. But if you considered like almost like dry hopping, like after the cook, like putting some grounds of pepper in right as you take it off, and then to get some – sit, let it sit with the aroma in, and then straining it off to get more of that fresh pepper aroma. Because if you noticed that – the aroma of the pepper changes and drops off and loses a lot of its kind of like interesting characteristics, especially if he's going to go all the way to like specify telecherry over a different variety of pepper. I don't know why he's hating on the Malabar. Like, you know what, that's the thing, Stas, remember we did all those pepper tastings back in the day? Stas has her I hate pepper tasting face. You don't like pepper on butter?
It was just boring.
Everything that requires sitting and like doing, you hate. Anyways, point being that other peppers are also good. I know telecherry's got the name. You know what I'm saying? But yeah. You know, like we do a pepper tincture. You know what my favorite thing to add to any pepper tincture is? Cubebs. I'm just gonna say it right there. Cubebs. Go. Have you played with cubebs?
I have not. I have a pink peppercorn tincture that we use at the bar. Put it in an atomizer and use that to kind of get like a wrench for the inside of the glass. It's awesome.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my pepper go-to of the you know, because we, you know, I'll do a pepper tincture and I'll throw in, because you always have all those pepper-like things sitting around, right? So you got like a couple different black peppers, like typically the two that I'm using are the Malabar and the telecherry, and I forget the third one. We sometimes use some other ones, but those are the main two that I'm using. And you always have a little bit of the grains of paradise, so that's a very strong flavor. I sometimes have a little bit of the long pepper, which strangely, even though it's not really – it's nowhere near the same flavor, the Romans like used it interchangeably with black pepper according to the research that I have, and cubebs. And some combination of all those can make really interesting kind of peppery aromas.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I'll play around with that.
Cool. Thanks. All right. So, hey, Jack.
He's not there.
Oh, he's not there. So the maple syrup guys, you can take a maple syrup tour, huh? They're our sponsors today.
Yes, that's true.
What do you think about that? What do you think about the maple syrup tour?
I think it sounds great. Their whole thing is they're like, you know, maple syrup is more than just a condiment for pancakes. So they're like, you get to tour the sugar shacks and they show you all these other products that they make with maple, like candies and things like that.
Sugar shack sounds vaguely like, you know, like some other stuff's going to happen in there, don't you think?
It's a family show. I don't know.
Yeah. But anyway, my point is, I was thinking about this the other day, and I'm such a jerk about it, but like, I have not noticed any huge terroir phenomenon in maple syrup. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I've had maple syrup from Connecticut. You know what it tastes like?
Maple syrup. Yeah.
You know, Vermont. You know what Vermont maple syrup tastes like?
Well, have you ever done a tasting? Like a side-by-side?
I'm saying. I think we should. I think we should get these guys to send it in and do like a side-by-side. Now, listen. There's a huge difference between the different grades of maple syrup and like early season versus late season, right? Because the earlier in the season, the clearer it runs. That's where you're getting your lighter syrups. And as the season goes on, it gets darker and darker until you get to the point where you get all this metallic taste that even like below grade B, right, which are even too strong for me. Like, I'm a solid B guy. I like B for eating. I like B for cooking. Like, I like B. You know what I mean? But it seems to me those effects like swamp like any sort of like locale effect. You know what I mean? What do you think? Am I wrong about this?
Well, we'll have to see. We're gonna have to do this.
We need someone to send in a tasting. You know what else I've really always wanted to do? I've always wanted to get a bunch of maple sap and then concentrate it in a rotovap.
We'll try to make it happen.
Right? To see, like, I want to know how much of the characteristic mapleness is because of the cooking itself versus just the extraction of water. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm sure someone out there has done evaporative boiling on this without heating it, but...
Sorry, I got a caller here.
All right, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, it's Chris from Green Zone.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, got a syrup question, actually.
Oh, nice. I haven't had a chance to look at the video yet. I heard you sent it to Jack, but I haven't seen the link yet on the coffee.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah. I just wanted to know what your go-to method for gum arabic is, because I couldn't actually find one in Liquid Intelligence.
Yeah,
gum syrup, I should say.
Yeah, I don't use it that often. Is why it's not in there. I did a bunch of tests once where we did the heavy gum syrups, and then tried to see how much of a difference it made, and our impression was that, you know, we didn't love it enough to, like, it wasn't one of those things where I'm like, my life has changed, and so now I'm going to do it, which is why it's not in there. The gum arabic I typically use is fairly, tweaked out, like, you know, from, like, Ticaloid, those guys. So I use it mainly as an emulsion, right? So
yeah, I'm using it that way as well also, you know, and methods that I got from your book. But as far as the pure gum syrup, I was just kind of curious.
Yeah, Wondrich has a bunch. Dave Wondrich has some gum syrup recipes that he published. I think it's in Imbibe, or it was one of the Esquire things he wrote about it, because I know he's a proponent of gum syrup. But, you know, that the interesting thing about gum arabic is that you can put a preposterous amount of it into solution, right? I mean, that's the kind of thing about it. It's like very, very high percentages of gum arabic, you know, don't form an extremely viscous solution. And it's because gum arabic is, you know, it's not a long chain polymer. It's not the way it works.
Right.
So
in your opinion, what do you think is a high proportion?
Oh, well, I don't know, like I don't do it, so I don't even think, but like over, like you can easily do like 10%, I think. I've never done it that high. Stas, remember we ran those tests?
Yeah.
You didn't really like it either, right? No. Yeah, I never really liked it. That's the thing. I think a lot of people also buy kind of like crap grades of gum arabic, and like they can have you know, different kind of tastes, and they're kind of dark. The stuff that I use is powdered and pure white.
Yeah, that's what I have too.
Yeah. And so, you know, look, here's what I think. Like, you know, use hot water, right? Blend it in, hydrate that sucker. I don't know whether mine is special that you don't have to heat it, like whether the stuff that I use is special, because I can't remember, but hot water is always going to make it easier, right? Blend the hell out of it, get it, then add your sugar to it. But start with a ridiculously high rate. This way, you can kind of see what happens when you go overboard. I always like to start with something ridiculous. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually followed Jeff Morgenthaler's recipe, which is like 6 parts sugar to 1 part gum to 2 parts water, and it's just this ridiculous sludge.
Yeah. Well, okay. So how does the recipe made? Tell me the steps.
So I saw one thing online that said you can blend it and you don't have to wait. But Morgenthaler says do 1 part gum, 1 part water, let it sit overnight, and it'll hydrate itself. And basically you just stir that into simple syrup, but he's using a 3-to-1 sugar to water ratio.
3-to-1. 3 parts sugar, 1 part water?
Yeah.
No. That must be a misprint. 3 parts sugar, 1 part water?
Yeah.
No.
It's on Imbibe, because they took it from the book, and it's in the book, and, you know, I don't know if this is a mistake, but yeah, this stuff is, like, super thick.
No, there's no
like,
way.
It would definitely not come out of a pour bottle. I would have to, like, spoon it into a drink.
Well, I'd have to calculate the bricks on that. 3 parts, well, we could do it, right? So it's 70-something bricks?
I guess.
Right? Yeah, 75 bricks. So, like, think about it this way. Honey is 82, right? And honey is completely inverted. If honey was had any sucrose remaining in it, right, it would crystallize instantly, right?
Right.
So you can't have sucrose mixtures at that high a brick. I mean, really, anything over above 66, 68 is going to start throwing crystals off, so it's going to be difficult. You could boil it to get it in. Does he boil it to get it in solution?
No, I blended it.
Wow. Yeah, I would imagine that would be hard.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the point of the gum is that it keeps it from crystallizing.
Huh. I guess, but it's still going to be – I mean, think about it. It's going to be thick.
Oh, yeah, it's super thick.
I mean, think about it this way, right? Maple syrup is around 66 bricks. You know how that pours, right?
Yeah.
You're adding a small amount of hydro to it, which maybe it does stop crystallizing. That's a good point, right? But the difference between 66 and 82, right, is not that much when you think about how much water is. And that's the difference between maple syrup and freaking honey.
I got to jump in. The chat room is going nuts. It's 2-to-1.
2-to-1. Yes. That makes a lot more sense. 2-to-1 would work.
Sugar to water?
That's what I guess the chat room
is saying. That's what they're saying, yeah. It's six waters, 3 sugar, 1 gum.
Now, that would work. That would definitely
work. Hold on, let me look up.
That would definitely work. Because 3 is bonkers. I don't even know that I could get it dissolved only with heat. But while we're going on this, some tricks. So if you're having trouble getting your gum arabic into solution, remember, any hydrocolloid wants to go into water if at all possible. So you want right. to you want to add the hydro before you add the sugar. The exception to that is you can dry blend your hydrocolloid with some of the sugar, right? So you can like blend equal parts gum arabic and sugar, and what you're doing there is just helping the gum arabic particles stay separate from each other to help them hydrate. So that's a time honored technique. But you don't need to freaking do that if you have a VitaPrep. You can just
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, so by the way, I'm looking at the book, and it is 2-1 if you consider that the water that's already in the gum mixture.
Oh, I see.
So he says 2 ounces gum arabic hydrated with 2 ounces of water, and then 12 ounces of sugar mixed with 4 ounces of water.
That's a lot of gum arabic. And plus,
yeah,
you're using I don't really like, what is the purported benefit? Does anyone in the chat room say that they love this stuff, that they use it every day, that it's the only syrup that they ever use, that this is like the love of their freaking life?
Well,
I'm using it at the bar tonight, so we're going to find out.
Yeah, it's just like, you know what? Here's the other thing, too. Like, what are you using it in? Like a lot of times people would use these gum syrups for like freaking like stirred and built drinks. Why? They just don't especially like a high break syrup like that doesn't dissolve in well. Are you shaking with it? What are you doing with it? You know what I'm saying? If you're shaking with it, there's no freaking point. I don't see that much of a point in going that high of a Brix because you're shaking. You're going to get all this extra dilution anyway. Do you know what I'm saying? So the reason, for instance, to go back to a completely different argument, has nothing to do with this. The old fashioned argument, there's all these people who like to make old fashioned with sugar, right? And the idea there is that you are not adding the extra water from the syrup. And all that means is that you want that first sip to be preposterously boozy, right? I mean, that's really all that means. Most people I know like a couple of even with syrup, like a cup, and it's only a tiny bit anyway. Let's be honest, a couple of stirs of the spoon anyway before they start drinking it. Most people,
yeah, absolutely,
except for hardcore, you know, booze hounds, and I know plenty, right?
Yes, like, so do I.
Want like a couple of spins of the spoon. Anyway, let us know what happens with the syrup. Jack, does anyone on the chat line say that they love it?
Let's see.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
we have a few no's in here.
I'm trying to use it in actually a shake and drink where I want a fair amount of viscosity and body.
Yeah, but so it doesn't add a lot of viscosity. That's the thing. That's why I don't get it. Like, it's a really good emulsifier, right? Like, if you were going to make a citrus syrup or any of these other things, like, it's a really good emulsifier to keep things like citrus oils suspended. Or if you're going to have any – yeah, I get it. You know what I mean? But, like, I just don't get it. I don't get it. As a texturizer, because I think other things do that better. Its main characteristic is that it can go in high proportion without becoming too viscous, and it's a great emulsifier, but it's not really a foaming agent. Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be shaking it up with milk, and so that'll certainly help, I think.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it has interaction with milk. I don't know. It's just one of those. I think it's one of those things that people do because they used to do it back in the old days. And like maybe there was some reason to do it back in the old days. Like, I don't know, maybe crystal inhibition. I don't know what. But I don't love it.
Cool. Well, I'll try it out tonight and let you know how it goes.
All right. Good luck. Okay.
I do have another call.
All right, caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? It's Anton from Boca.
Hey, what's up?
How's it going? Hey, I'm going to Japan on Thursday. I'm going to be there for 3 weeks. I wanted to see if there's any place that you get an Ikejime fish at all.
Oh.
I also wanted to know any other recommendations of places of going to.
So you going to Tokyo?
Yeah.
Okay. So I would definitely see if you could get a tour of Tsukiji Market. Like, Stas and I went on this awesome tour there, but we got you have to meet up with someone, right? Like, you can't just tour it anymore.
I don't know.
Like, who are you going as part of for business, or are you just going?
Just going, pleasure. I believe I'm going to the tour of the market the second day I'm there.
Yeah.
The second day.
So that that there is life-changing, right? And like, I don't know, like, if you speak or have someone translating, but let them know in advance what you kind of want to see. Because everyone is like, oh, well, you know, someone's coming to the market. They want to see the tuna auction. And that's great. That's fine. Awesome. But like, you want to see people doing like the different techniques, like fish butchering, you know, ikijime, which you can all see there. So if you just let like the tour guide or the host know what it is you want to see, you know, they'll probably show you. So, you know, then what time of year is it? Is it spring yet over there? Is it Hamo yet? When we were there, what time of year were we there, Stas? It was a little later, right?
Yeah.
It was all that freaking Hamo, all that like all that bone with the crunchy. That's the thing. Everything's seasonal, so it depends on what's in season right now is what you're going to get a whole boatload of. Anything you remember, like particular places?
No.
So, what was the one that Mark went to that he loved so much? He said it was the best place he's ever been.
Don't remember.
Oh, man. When are you going? 2 weeks?
I'm leaving Thursday. Thursday. Yeah.
Go to the chat. People should call in on the chat room and see who's good or like, you know, you know, we have some crew over in Japan right now. They should give you some recommendations on our chat room. We'll go to see. But all I'm saying is that I would be very clear what it is that you're interested in seeing when you go like on a food tour or anything like this, because I think in general, like people who listen to this show have a different set of interests than the average tourist jackweed who shows up somewhere. And yeah. I think that in general, people like cater tours, even of things like the fish market, to what the average jackweed wants.
Got to go with jackweed, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. And, well, dude, it's not like you, Jack. It's like, But I don't also know what the current exchange rate is, but, like, have someone take you to, like, the knife shops. I would go to the, do you remember the name of the street, Stas, with the big, with the chef hat dude on it?
No.
There's one street, and I want to say it's Kobayashi, but I made that up because it's like a Star Trek reference or something like that. But like, go to that street and like check out. I absolutely love seeing kitchen like commercial kitchen equipment districts in different countries. Every country I go, I try to go to market and to like a commercial kitchen equipment outlet area, and I'm sure you'll find some fun stuff.
Awesome. I know we're going to go to the Yamazaki distillery and then hopefully try to see some sake brewery as well.
Oh, nice. You know what? I never went when I was there. I really wish I would like good traditional miso production would be nice. I hear I've never been to Yamazaki, but I know people that have gone that I thought it was a great tour. So, you know, let us know what happens.
Cool. Fair enough. Sounds good, man.
All right.
I'll let you know what I find. Thanks, man.
All right, cool. Speaking oh, look.
Hey, look, it's Peter Kim.
Peter Kim. Oh. Peter Kim. Shows up just in time to get the free lunch. So, Peter. You know, Peter Kim, by the way.
I'm here for the pizza, not the friendship.
Yeah.
Do you want a menu, Peter?
Oh,
I
Peter
can bring
Kim.
A menu.
The,
you want to start with drinks?
What are you? Are you the president or the director? I can never get straight.
Dude, who cares? Yeah.
Of the Museum of Food and Drink. Yeah, How's it going over there?
Yeah, man. It's going all right. Yeah. We're still kicking.
Yeah?
Yeah. Nice. Not that you check on us that often. Or not.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, so last week they had a technical difficulty with some of – you know, for those of you who don't know, Museum of Food and Drink opened right now with an exhibit on the birth of the flavor industry. And I hear you guys were having some technical problems with one of the machines. Did you get it fixed?
We're still troubleshooting it.
Oh, son of a gun. I'm going to have to go over there and fix it, aren't I?
Oh, yeah.
I'm just saying.
It's just the – yeah, we've
saying,
got
– grape. Listen. Okay.
Everything smells like popcorn is one thing. So
everything?
Well, it's just popcorn constantly comes out. Every time you press any button, we have this thing called the smell synth, and it has 19 different arcade buttons, releases different smells, and you can press them to create all these different flavor combinations. One of them releases pyrazine, which has a popcorn smell to it. And for whatever reason, whenever you press any button, the pyrazine jar, it shakes, and there's a little air that goes through. So there's a slight popcorn note to everything right now at the smell synth.
Did it?
So it seems like it's like a programming thing.
Well, how could that
I don't know, man.
Be?
Probably because I went in and tried to futz around with it.
Did someone actually try to futz around with it?
No, of course not. I just want to see. I think the best episodes of Cooking Issues are when Dave turns into the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah.
And so I basically just keep poking. It's like I take the Sleeping Lion and just keep like poking him with the broomstick.
Could be worse. It could all smell like cheesy vomit.
Yeah, it's true.
Which is another one of the buttons.
Yeah, that's the one that actually runs out the fastest.
Oh, really?
Because people like the cheesy vomit?
Yeah, everybody. I watch this all the time where everybody's like, oh, cheesy vomit. Oh, try it. And then you go back for it. Yeah,
well,
exactly.
That's like I've always said, like when you're – I don't want to get into it. Family show. Not family. It's just gross.
Wow.
Just gross. Like whenever you get – let me put it this way. Whenever you get something nasty smelling on your finger, you have to smell it.
Wow.
There are a small subset of the people who will not smell their finger before
really?
They clean it off. Yes.
Yeah. There is that classic saying that man with itchy butt has smelly finger.
Where is that a classic saying?
In China, where he's from.
In the Kim household.
Wow. Oh. We have one more caller. If we
all right.
On that note.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello?
Hey.
Hi, this is Bill from Fullerton, California.
How you doing? Wait, where's
really
Fullerton?
Good.
Where's Fullerton?
I'm a long time past listener, and so it's great to actually finally be talking to you live.
Oh, nice. Where's Fullerton?
Fullerton is Orange County,
okay.
South of L.A.
All right, so Stas knows it well.
Mm-hmm.
How, are you close to her home country of Covina?
yeah, nearby.
Nice. I realized that Covina is in a disproportionate number of movies that involve teenagers or anything else happening. Like, it's all like Good Burgers, Covina. Every time I watch a movie like that, it's Covina, Covina, Covina. You ever notice that?
I honestly haven't watched a lot of those movies. I'm not sure why.
Yeah, strange. All right, what's your question? Let's get to your question.
Okay. I'm wondering, and I've listened to the back catalog. And I don't know if you've ever addressed this. I really want to refill my SodaStream bottle with dry ice.
Oh.
But I wanted your take on it, whether or not that was extremely dangerous to do.
Yeah. I'm going to file that one under – listen, I've seen the YouTube what's it called, where people do that, right? I'm going to go ahead and file that one under not advisable because, look, here's the truth.
And like, when Dave Arnold files something under not advisable, that is really not advisable.
Yeah, because it's just, you know, you could get it wrong. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
right.
You know, theoretically, it's all fine and good. You open it. Here's the other trick. You have to let the CO2 build up before you close it again, right, because you don't want any oxygen in there at all. So you have to tear out your you have to open it. You have to tear out your bottle on a scale, right? And you have to get a scale that's going to sit there long enough because you don't want the sucker turning off. This is why I always advocate if you can afford having a plug-in scale, like get a plug-in scale so that it doesn't turn off on you. I hate when scales turn off in the middle of a measurement. Hate. So you get this scale there. It has to be enough to weigh the bottle and the contents that are in it. You tear it out empty. Then you have to throw in your pre-weighed nuggets, right? You have to make sure it's the right weight. Let it off-gas for a little bit to clear out the excess oxygen. And then cap it and pray that you've measured right. If you've measured right, it should all be good because you know how they fill CO2 tanks? They fill them by weight. They don't fill them by volume or anything like that. But
right.
I would say, and again, I'm not recommending you do this, but if you are going to do it, I would always go a little bit under instead of a little bit over.
Okay.
A little bit over,
okay.
Very bad.
Okay, well, I guess I won't do it then. I mean, I wasn't even sure if it would end up saving me money based on how much dry ice I would end up needing to buy. So I... And then I was also curious if there was a built-in safety valve to make it more safe than if there wasn't a safety valve.
Answer is now you're stretching my memory. There is an overpressure safety on those things, but I don't think you want them to go off on you. You know what I mean? I think that little thing on the right is an overpressure safety. That little hex looking thing on the right is an overpressure safety thing. But I wouldn't want to rely. Here's the other thing. So like I fill my own CO2 tanks, my large CO2 tanks, right? So I'll have like one of the large cylinders, and I'll fill smaller cylinders, or I'll do gas mixtures in them. But I'm doing it like pretty carefully by weight. And if you ever go that route, you know, that's also can be unsafe. And so I wouldn't recommend unless you look into it, because you don't want to overfill it. But what I would do is, does your SodaStream live in one space in your place, or does it move around the house?
It just moves like from above my fridge to my counter to back up above my fridge.
Okay. So, I'm sure someone out there has done this already, but it is rather trivial to just make an adapter to have it go to a real tank.
Oh, really?
Yeah, done. Then you just have the line running up to the SodaStream, screw it on with the adapter, you're done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where would I find info on that?
I don't know. I should look at it, because I've had enough people ask me about it. But yeah, you could. I don't know. People have done it. The real problem is this: like people, it's a very simple machine work job to do it, right? Very simple. And then people, because you know they're not going to sell that many of them, they need to charge an exorbitant amount of money. So the question is: has anyone done it in like quantities large enough such that the price is reasonable? Like that's the thing. But think about it this way. To me, like large tanks isn't just about price, although price is a factor. It's all about like how much do you hate those little bottles running out all the freaking time?
Totally. I know.
You hate it.
It's brutal.
Yeah. And then you're like, well,
$15 a pop.
Oh, jeez. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I share this struggle at home.
That's a preposterous amount of money. That's absurd.
It's preposterous by design.
Now, the price of CO2 has gone up recently over the past couple of years, but not by that much. You know what I mean? I think I pay $15 now for like 5 or 10 pounds of this stuff. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, my friend has like the under-the-counter rig that per your instructions, and I think he does pay like just like about the same amount or a little more than what I pay. For however much he has, I'm not sure how much, but way more than me.
Yeah, so like the rig that I use, right, which is the one with the carbonator caps and the bag and bottle things. Here's the problem with it: my entire family is so freaking nanny poo on carbonating that way. They're like, man, it's so hard to put the valve onto the thing.
It was
man.
A little hard.
Suck it up. Oh, in my house in Connecticut, it's freaking suck it up. And like Dax, my 11-year-old, he's like pushing on it, and like I'm just staring at him because he has to man up and like put the cap on the thing, right? Yeah, I can't just sit there.
That one is very hard.
Oh, come on.
That one is very hard.
How hard can it be, Stas?
Really hard.
How hard can it be? It's not like I'm like the strongest man on earth. I can make seltzer, not
you
problem.
Are the strongest man on earth.
Anyway, my point being that that some people in your family might go a little nanny poo on it, and like they have to go through a rigmarole every time. For me, it's easy. Like carbonating that way is just as easy as carbonating in a SodaStream. In fact, easier, because I can do it and leave it in the fridge, all kinds of stuff. But just be aware, if you do switch to a carbonator cap setup, be ready for some nanny poo from your family and friends.
Okay, noted.
Yeah. Alrighty. Good luck with it.
Thank you. Long live Indie Jesus.
Oh, I wish we still had Indie Jesus. Wow. Where is he, Jack?
That's a great question. I'm sure he's doing well, though. Can I share a quick story? So somebody who I won't name that works next door at the takeout spot came up to me, and they were like, hey, so, well, wow, maybe I shouldn't tell this whole story. Long story short, they say, who is Santa's little hipster? And I'm like, how did you know about that? And they're like, well, somebody that I know is a fan of the show, and they asked me to find out who Santa's little hipster is.
He lives in all of our hearts.
I haven't seen Santa's little hipster in a long time.
Not working here anymore.
Is he?
We're kind of like without a new character, you know. We got to find that person.
Yeah, we got to find someone. Yeah, who's like worthy of Stas's, fertile ire.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Cool.
If few minutes here.
All right. Okay. So let me get some of the questions. Hey, guys. This is Steve Yoon from Los Angeles. A few weeks ago, Johnny Hunter revealed on your show that he had developed a way to make black garlic in 3 days and that he would be revealing it at a MoFat event and possibly on the radio show later. Can you bug him for his recipe again? Me and several friends are anxiously waiting with our ears stuck to the radio, waiting to see if the quick black garlic recipe would become public. My mom makes it all the time in her rice cooker and taught me that the typical 3 week method. I'd like to be able to blow her mind once by making it over the weekend while visiting her. Ah, okay, listen. We have to get Johnny said he made it public. Is that stuff on the air? Can you go watch that demo?
No.
Did he videotape that demo?
No.
So nice. Thanks.
Yeah. We can get it from Johnny. Yeah.
I mean, roughly what he does is he doesn't use a rice cooker. He uses a crock pot. He leaves the garlic in the skins, breaks it up, like mists it a little bit, right, with water, wraps it in moist paper towels, and then puts it in aluminum foil in the crock pot, closes the crock pot, hits go, and then there's a towel, I think, also in the crock pot, a moist towel, and then just keeps re-upping that and like overturning it like once a day or so and goes. Yeah. That's roughly what he does.
Yeah. Something like that. Yep.
Yeah. But we'll get Johnny to call us because he did say he was going to make it public. And so maybe we'll get him to call in next week, the week after, and just go through it really quickly. But that's the gist.
Yeah. You have his contact info, man?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
I think Stas is going to do it. I don't even call my family.
Yeah.
You know, I don't call people. Do I look like I call people? Stas, do I call people?
Nope.
No.
Anyway. Yeah.
Let me see. Dear Jack, on a food website.
Dear me, huh?
Yeah, dear you.
Well, let's see.
Stella Culinary, I asked the founder if he agreed with blast chilling sous vide proteins. He quoted Dave Arnold. He said, Dave Arnold says a slower chill is best for texture and flavor. If at all possible, please ask why slow chill is best. Thanks, Joan. Okay, here's the deal. I didn't used to believe this was the case. This is actually Bruno Gusseau's thing. You know, Bruno Gusseau, the grandpappy of low-temperature cooking. And so he always said that you want to ramp the cooling down. And the reason is that as meat is passing through a particular temperature, he always said it was somewhere around 50 degrees Celsius. As the meat is passing through that temperature, it's absorbing the liquids that it's expelled during the cook, right? And so if you rapidly force meat from cook temperature down, it won't have the time to reabsorb that, because at low temperatures it won't reabsorb the liquids, and obviously at high temperatures it won't reabsorb the liquids. And so, you know, he used to advocate a three-step chilling, where he would take the bags out, leave them on the counter, because air is not very good at heat conductor, so it doesn't cool. It doesn't cool it off very quickly. Then he would, after 15 or 20 minutes, depending on how thick it was, he would put it into tap water, like room temperature tap water, to bring it down to that. And then after that, he would ice it down. And so what I would say is that blast chilling is great once it's done its initial chilling. So once it's initially chilled down, right, and it's reabsorbed whatever juices it's going to reabsorb, once it gets down to, you know, in the kind of room temperature, or not even a little warmer than room temperature, then you can hit it in the blast chill and take it down like a rock. What do you think, Jack? Did I answer the question?
I think so.
All right.
That's going to be about it.
All right. So next week we'll have to get to a Leahy Bittman style no knead bread question, which we have to get to, and we have a mocktail question.
Mock duck.
Mock duck. Interesting. You want to talk about? You have 5 seconds to discuss mock duck. Not mock duck. The excellent. By the way, I in general don't like fake vegetarian stuff, but some traditional stuff. I think mock duck is delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Like actual mock duck.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Me too.
Yeah, it's good. And I have some egg white questions. I have some good stuff. And how well to hack your soda siphons and your EC bottles. There are some tricks. We'll get to it next time on Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.